You're listening to Around Comics, Watching Before Watchmen, comedian number one. Back another episode of Around Comics. This is another special edition, the Watching Before Watchmen. For those of you that don't know what this is, we are going to take a look at every single individual issue of the Before Watchmen event from DC Comics. This is the prequels to the all-time great comic book series Watchmen from Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons. The much ballyhooed prequels that people said would never happen have happened, so we're going to take a look at them and see if they're any damn good. This is our third episode, and this is the first issue of Comedian from Brian Azzarello and J.G. Jones, with colors by Alex Sinclair, letters by Clem Robbins, and covers by J.G. Jones, Eduardo Rizzo, Jim Lee, and others. I am Brian Salazar. You can call me Sal, and I am joined by Braxton Harrison. What's up, Braxton?
How's it going? And you can call me Braxton.
Braxton, Mr. Braxton Harrison.
Yes, my mother calls me Brack with
Does
a K.
She?
Yeah, Dan.
Where did your mother ever come up with that name, Braxton?
I'm not sure where she. I think she just. It's kind of a southern.
Is it?
I
never heard
it
before.
But you know, I see a lot of toddlers these days.
Named Braxton? Name,
yeah, so it's
really?
Gaining it's gaining popularity.
Wow. Strange. How odd.
Yeah.
You're the only person I've ever met with that name, but I'm not in the South.
Well, so. There's more to come, so more. Just wait.
Soon.
Yes.
All right, well, let's jump into this issue of Comedian Number One. You're gonna lead us through
the
journey.
Yeah, let me start it off. This is... I think this may be my first experience with J.G. Jones, unless – did he do the JSA back?
He did – let's see. Well, he did the Grant Morrison 1 year later, the big event that happened after
I'll have to look and see what he did that's older than that, because I remember him from something and –
He did the Final Crisis. Let's see. I'm just going to look it up here.
Maybe it was some 52 action, perhaps, in DC.
Well, he was. I think he had part of that. He did Final Crisis. I don't know what else he's done. Let's see. Oh, he's done a lot of stuff. Wonder Woman, The Avengers, Legacy, DC Universe Legacies, Black Widow.
Well, who knows then? I mean, if he's that... prolific.
First Wave. He did First Wave.
Yeah. There's no telling where I ran across him. But our story starts with we're outside of a ranch, a really nice ranch home. Looks like it's nighttime. We're clearly seeing the outside of the residence. It's nighttime. It must be the backyard. There's the pool. And
I'm going to guess it's California. Maybe.
I was going to say it's a California ranch, but. How can you tell if it's a California ranch?
But I don't know. Just a guess.
Yeah, just a guess. And we see this gentleman picking up a baseball by the bed, and we have I'm the Wanderer by – who sings this song?
Dion.
Dion. Well, that's the only thing going on in the background is Dion's the Wanderer playing, and – I guess this is old Eddie Blake picking up this baseball, and we see a signature Can we read the signature?
I did.
I know who it is just because of.
Well, it says love always Joe. Yeah. So we'll find out.
We're to assume that it's got to be Joe DiMaggio. I would reckon.
Well, we do. Yeah, as the events unfold, we could guess that is Joe DiMaggio.
So this seems to be kind of a quiet moment with old Eddie Blake as he's looking at the ball. He's enjoying one of his signature cigars.
And you can see, he's naked in a bed, and there appears to be another figure in the bed with
like
him.
Kind of a womanly figure. So it's
possibly post-coital.
Potentially. All right. So we turn the page, and we're not sure of the timeline here. There's no before or earlier or anything like that. It just starts off with some guys playing football in the backyard. This looks like the Hamptons, right?
Sort of looks East Coast. There's water. It looks very.
We got some seagulls.
Yeah.
We see some very toothy gentlemen that Eddie Blake is playing, throwing the pigskin.
Ara, you're not getting by me, Eddie.
Yeah, so these toothy gentlemen turn out to be Jack and Teddy Kennedy.
Jack and Bobby and Teddy.
Oh, yep, Bobby's in there too.
I can't do a Kennedy, but yeah, it's the Kennedy boys.
Yep.
In their prime, it looks like, and they were known to play football out at camp, whatever the hell it was. I can't remember now. I should have probably looked that up, but I can't remember.
So this is not the Hamptons then? The Kennedys are from, they're from Connecticut, right? Where are the Kennedys from?
Yeah, originally, I think I'm trying to remember if they, at this time he is president.
Yeah. So this could be Camp
David.
Was there
Camp
David?
Camp David at that time? I don't remember. It's too long ago, and I haven't done any research. So
either way,
they're somewhere playing football in,
with the Kennedys, all the brothers, and Eddie Blake, tussles around with them and takes a break and goes inside the house to what's clearly Jackie O. What do they say? Anything? That's really important other than,
well, you know, it's interesting.
Goofing off.
You mean Jackie and Eddie?
Well, before that.
Oh, well, no, they're just setting up, like, obviously there's a close relationship. It seems like between Eddie and the Kennedys, for whatever reason, they seem to like one another and, they're just kind of goofing around. They're just kind of being guys playing football out in the yard. And Eddie decides to take a break and go inside.
And I don't know about you, Brian Salazar, but if Eddie Blake is going into the house where my wife is, I would probably take a break with him.
Take a break? You wouldn't?
Yeah.
Well, you have to remember.
But, you know, this is funny because we saw how the comedian was depicted when he was 16 years old already. So apparently he goes legit at some point in his adult life, or at least seemingly respectable enough to be breaking bread with, you know, the president.
Well, we know that at one point he, you know, starts to work for the government and does, you know, does a lot of dirty work, presumably for like the CIA, and now we look at, you know, it looks like the Kennedys, you know, he was involved in Vietnam, and he, you know, was probably involved in a lot of other sort of.
Yeah, we see the specifics.
And if you think about the Kennedys, it's not like they were opposed to hanging out with nefarious, questionable characters. I mean, whether it was, you know, Sinatra and some of the guys that he was involved with, you know, his sort of gangster connections, that kind of stuff, or that kind of thing. So I think it's interesting, but it's not. I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that they would like someone like Eddie because they were, you know, they were kind of men.
They had to have some muscle guy in there to do, I guess, dirty work when it needed to be done.
Yeah, and I guess the surprising thing is that this sort of, and we see it really with the conversation with Jackie, it sets Eddie up as being, he really respects Jack and Bobby, which is something, you know, that I think we haven't seen out of that character yet, of him having respect really for anybody or anything.
That's true, yep.
So that's sort of a new thing of going, well, is this before, you know, before he kind of loses it, and what causes that, you know, change in him?
Potentially.
It's interesting, you know, and you have to also remember that what we saw before in the Minutemen is from Hollis's perspective. So, you know, what Hollis may have seen him as a 16-year-old, and what the Kennedys or what, you know,
what he actually is, because this isn't told from someone's perspective. This is just
right.
Yeah, this is just how it is, and playing on the respect that Eddie Blake has for the Kennedy brothers, Jackie O is going to enlist him into a job, and she's using, the respect that he has for them as a motivator.
Well, yeah, I think you find two things in this conversation, which is really well written. You see her, you know, she wants something from Eddie, and she, you know, she uses the respect that he has for Jack against him, but also the respect that he has of the office of the president, his patriotic, you know, I guess,
sensibility,
and also a bit of guilt that, you know, I can't say that I'm a Kennedy buff.
But a bit of guilt that he knows about the indiscretions that...
And it's really an interesting thing because that's sort of like, you know, if you look at their story in reality, in our, you know, in our timeline, in our, you know, it's like how many people knew what Jack Kennedy was doing behind her back, including her maybe, potentially, from what we can tell. It seems like she did know what he was doing. But how many people that she would be around all the time had to look her in the face and, you know, maybe lie, maybe, you know, hide the truth from her, that kind of thing. And so you see that here with Eddie feels bad about the fact that that he knows what Jack's doing to her, and she knows it, and so she's using that too to get what she wants.
Well, let's go ahead and voice what it is that's happening. Basically, Jackie O and almost a flirtatious conversation. I thought it was heading in some kind of inappropriate flirtatious conversation, but it doesn't ever quite get there. She is basically asking Eddie Blake that, look, you need to do something about this drug-addled
peroxide
whore, which, of course, is Marilyn Monroe.
Right, and yeah, she talks about the fact that now she's hanging around Sam Giancana, the Chicago gangster that you know ran the mob at that time, and you know when she's drugged up, she has a very loose tongue. So who knows what she could be telling?
Who knows?
Who knows what she could be saying to Sam and his cronies? So yeah, she elicits Eddie to go and take care of Marilyn.
Yeah. So I think that maybe I read this as she brought it to his attention, and he saw a real danger here and was like, oh, you're right, we definitely need to do something. I don't think that he, oh, this is just an opportunity for me to kill. You know, I didn't read it like that. He
loves
the Kennedys and or the brothers, and he he feels that this is a service that, you know, he this is something that should probably happen.
For the good of the country, he believes that it's necessary to keep.
Yeah. So we're learning about Eddie Blake, and this is all real new territory that, you know, this was not a story told, even though as much of The Watchmen that there is about Eddie Blake, and it's, you know, he's almost a central character. This is kind of some ground that I think Moore never spoke of about him this past.
Yeah, I mean, it's I think Azzarello does a nice job of extrapolating potentially what Eddie would have been like in the early 1960s, what he would have been as
by the little tidbits and maybe the pictures of the photographs that we've seen in The Watchmen.
Well, and you think of it in the sense of, you know, a lot of the things that Eddie says in Watchmen, you know, lead you to think of him as a certain type of individual. His moral, he's not like devoid of morality necessarily. He has his own certain, the way he looks at things. And so if you kind of, you know, reverse engineer that and go, well, how did he get there? You know, like how
yeah.
did he get to
and
that?
You know, if you think about the Eddie Blake of Watchmen, there is a breaking point to his sensibilities the tearful when he visits Moloch the Mystic and breaks down. I mean, he does have a point or a place where I suppose even as the horror that he is, he can't go. So, you know, this last time we were talking about how I was kind of longing and pining for some positive redeeming characteristics to some of these cats. And it looks like maybe we'll get that with the least expected one of all. And that's the comedian.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think be careful a bit. I mean, you know, he is still going and murdering a relatively innocent woman. You know that
it's Marilyn Monroe.
Well, it's Marilyn Monroe, but I mean,
drug-addled peroxide whore, please.
Well, yes, but that doesn't warrant, you know, being poisoned to death.
I guess that's what he did.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you look
I mean, we're getting into history now, so that's how she
Died,
how she checked out.
You know, there are plenty of people that believe that.
Let me just go ahead and say real quickly, I never wished death to Marilyn Monroe.
Well, that's good.
Okay.
You are a Southerner, so, you know, I would hope you would be a gentleman.
we love our blondes, please. So the next scene we move on to, and we still never get the any linear headline that lets you know where we are, but you really understand exactly what happens.
Well, I think color, the use of color certainly plays into.
Yeah, we're back, and of course the same song is playing, The Wanderer, and we're back in the California ranch, and we see what's clearly Marilyn Monroe, and everything makes sense. Eddie's getting up. I guess he got to bang old Marilyn there before she checked out.
Well, who didn't?
Apparently.
Yeah, well, that certainly is insinuated that, you know, he gets up from bed, they're both naked and he's getting dressed, but she's gone now at this point. Yeah. So at some point he
kisses her on her bare ass cheek.
Which I just have to bring up one of the sort of conspiracy things about the death of Marilyn Monroe, and you know, there was a enormous amount of barbiturates found in her body, in her bloodstream. The autopsy found just huge amounts of barbiturates in her bloodstream, but the coroner was not able to find any sort of residue that would suggest that she swallowed the amount of pills necessary to get that much in her bloodstream. So the conspiracy always was, or the thought at that point was, that
Someone bit her on the ass.
No, it would have been because it wasn't injected. There was no sign of any injection. That it would have been a suppository or an enema, basically a barbiturate suppository that someone used to kill her. So I don't know if Azzarello is sort of suggesting.
I don't think so either.
I don't know, But, you know, the funny thing is when he went and kisses her on the butt, it seemed like such a weird, kind of an odd scene. Like, why that?
Well,
why?
I think it's almost, this is going to sound strange, but a little bit respectful, you know.
Kissing maybe. Her ass a little?
Look.
I'm sorry I had to do it.
I'll kiss your ass, and I'm sorry. A little bit of a farewell.
I think you definitely, from the opening scene and this scene, you get the sense that Eddie is reluctantly doing this. Like, he does have a certain he is a bit mournful about it.
I don't know. I mean, maybe that, or maybe he's kind of dead inside. I don't think we have enough information to glean that he's mournful.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess
it's awesome he got that signed baseball, though.
He did walk out with the baseball. He leaves with the Joe DiMaggio baseball.
He gangsta snatched that right on up.
Well,
why not, you know?
It's Joe DiMaggio, man. Come on.
Yeah.
Did you know that for 20 years after Marilyn's death, Joe DiMaggio had flowers delivered to her grave 3 times a week, roses. That's pretty amazing.
Did he remarry or anything?
He never married her. No, they were married. They were married.
Oh, they were.
Yeah, and he never did remarry. No.
That's pretty classy.
Yeah.
So the next scene, we're at a bar. And apparently, there must have been some research on Azzarello's part to find out what games were going on around. Because we have a moment in time now. It was right around, two things, I suppose. I won't shoot ahead. But Eddie Blake's in a bar. He's watching a game between, is it the Giants?
It's the Giants, and I didn't get a chance to look up. I was trying to find what game it may have been. I don't know. I mean, I know that Brian is a big sports fan. So I'm sure. Yeah, this is a
specific game.
I just don't know.
All right. Do you know what city Eddie Blake's in? What in this bar where he's at exactly?
Well, I would. If they're watching the Giants game, I'm thinking he's in New York.
Well, the guy, the bartender, he's apparently going against the flow.
Well, he bet against the Giants, so I'm thinking that they're in New York. Let's see. This makes a lot of sense. There's a game October 27th, 1963. Which would be not long before the Kennedy assassination. New York Giants win 33-6 against the Cleveland Browns. So that would be close. Let's see, Packers. I'm trying to think. That's week 7 of the NFL. I'm sorry, I'm looking all this up as we're going, so I know it's sort of annoying, but. 1963 games. Let me see if there's one. Giants, Cowboys. No, that's October, November. Giants, Redskins. They won 44-14. I think that's the game. It's Sunday, December 8th, 1963. The New York Giants are playing the Washington Redskins. They win the game 44-14.
So that's the day.
December 8th, which would be, because
very good.
It's 4 days.
Very good, Sal.
Yeah.
So anyway, we get a, looks like Eddie gets a call. Someone knows he's at this bar. We turn the page, and it's old Kennedy.
I'm sorry. That can't be it. I'm wrong. I'm thinking December. It would be, it was. it's November, so it has to be in November. Wait, let me just look. Sorry,
You're heading into editing yourself out mode.
November 17th, the Giants beat the San Francisco 49ers 48-14. That's got to be it, because the next game the Giants play would be November 24th, and that would be
after.
So it's got to be, yeah, the 49ers Sunday, November 24th. Sunday, November 17th against the 49ers. There you go. Sorry.
All right. Well, we know the exact date that Brian L. Azzarello wrote. We know if we just knew the bar, you know. Let's see if we can figure out what the furniture.
What bar he's at by the furniture? You think I could? I don't know. If I spend enough time, let's see. There's a.
Well, anyway.
There's men in hats. And
yeah. Eddie Blake gets a call, and he goes over to yuck it up with the president, and that's who is that with him? Is that Jack?
Yeah, that was Bobby.
Bobby.
Jack's
nope,
on the Bobby's on the or Jack's on the phone, and Bobby's standing up next to him. Yeah.
Yeah, and they're you get a good sense of their relationship here, and they're really winding up Eddie Blake, and Eddie Blake's winding them back, and they're taking the piss out of each other.
Evidently, they had a bet on the game, and the president took the Niners, and Eddie took the Giants. I'm sorry, the other way around. Eddie took the Niners, and Jack took the Giants. So Eddie's losing the bet.
So President Kennedy asked Eddie to come. He says, "I'll see you on Friday." And then Eddie says, "Yeah, I'm on the first flight. I really don't see why, though." And that kind of confused me. I didn't know, because I wasn't sure where he was at. I mean, was he still close by somewhere in California? And, you know, why is it kind of odd that he's finding it odd that Jack Kennedy is asking him to come in? So that may mean something later on. We're not sure.
Yeah, I mean, he kind of says, he says in the kind of the last panel, he says, "Eddie, we've been friends since the Pacific.
Yeah,
you, the comedian, are a hero, and not to blow my own horn, but I am too. For some people, I think it's a good time that all heroes unite." And then one thing that suggests is that they may have fought together in the Pacific.
So, what do you think the comedian persona was at this point in time? Is it something that he's retired, or is it something that it's a joke maybe, and he's kind of moved it on to bigger, better things? Those bigger, better things being doing wet works for the Kennedys.
Well,
the CIA.
When was the Keene Act? Cause
that may have pushed him out. Yeah.
Let's see. That was, let me see if I can, because that was sort of the thing was the
that's
Keene,
probably
the
Keene, what happened. Yeah, the I mean, Keene, I'm Keene sure Act, the Keene Act pushed him out.
The Keene Act was passed, and then he went to work. The Keene Act wasn't passed until 1977. So yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure what. I don't know. I mean, we don't really know yet what Eddie's position was. Where,
we get an indication of it, I think, maybe on the next page when he is heading out on the flight and someone from the FBI stops him and says, "I know you're on your way out, but we need your help with something." And so Eddie looks through this file, and apparently they need him as the comedian to make an appearance as the comedian. And Eddie Blake says this is kindergarten shit.
Right.
Apparently he doesn't really want to do it. So, but he does go along. Is there anything else you wanted to?
No, I mean, this is on the surface, this is a pretty, benign scene. It's just like, oh, okay, he's going to go do a quick little job before you know, before heading off to meet Jack. I mean, you know, at this point, it's very well done because you're not really thinking anything at this point. You're just sort of going along with it. At least I was. I wasn't really, you know, thinking anything other than they're looking for, you know, he needs to do a quick job before he jumps on a plane to meet Jack. So,
so we're at the. Still don't know what city this is.
Yeah, I don't know that it matters. I mean, I'm not sure where he's flying out of. But well, I mean, those guys were all based in New York, weren't they? I mean, wasn't Moloch and Eddie and those? I mean,
yeah, maybe so. Maybe New York. So they go out on this case. They're heading out to apparently go do a bust of Moloch, who up until this point was content to run the old prostitute ring, apparently. Now he, according to the FBI, he's pushing narcotics, which has gotten the attention of them. And I guess because it is Moloch, that is why they wanted to get the comedian in on it.
Right. He's sort
of. You think this might be a publicity thing? I noticed that there's a camera crew set up, but.
Well, he said right away, he said, you know, my boss loves getting his face in front of the pictures. And Hoover was certainly that way. Hoover was very much known for, at least really early on.
Propagandizing the whole.
His, you know, the CIA. I mean, yeah. You know, he was, or I mean the FBI.
Yeah.
He was very much, you know, the kind of, he would take credit for what his agents would do. And he was the face of the FBI, so he became a national figure because of it. So it's not out of the realm of possibilities of thinking that he's sort of, while this isn't a setup, they're going to take the opportunity to go in there and you know, get some PR out of it.
I'd also like to say that these are Lincoln Continentals, right? Best Lincoln Continentals
I
have ever seen rendered in a comic book.
Yeah, they're nice. I mean, I don't know if they got like the suicide doors on them. I don't know what year that would be.
Yeah, they do. The last panel, you can see them big suicide doors rocking. I don't know. I guess Jones may have used some, I don't know if he went in with a 3D warehouse, pulled some photos of
Lincoln's.
Yeah, but that he did it great. It doesn't look like he relied on photographs at all. It looks like it melds with everything.
Yeah,
even the dash and everything, the steering wheel. It's all very
the grill, the dash. Yeah, I mean it's of the era for certain.
So so the comedian amps it up a notch. He pulls an Emeril Lagasse and pumps it up a notch. And,
well, yeah, because they're basically telling them, hey, local law enforcement goes in first, then we're going to go in, make sure everything's clear, and then you come in, and we'll get the camera crews, and you take over. And he decides, I don't think that's how it's going to happen, and proceeds to gangbuster his way in.
Yeah, which is really wise, I guess, for the series. We get to see some great action from the comedian of what we would anticipate he would do. He goes in and starts clearing house in a great two-page kind of a diagonal spread.
Mm-hmm.
Which another thing is we're not even worried about nine-panel grids in this whole.
Well,
I was going to DC comic-y.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. Like, this is the first one that isn't anywhere close to nine-panel. It doesn't look at all.
No, this looks like a modern comic.
Yeah,
as DC would put out. And so the next scene we see where Eddie, or the comedian right now, catches up to Moloch. And I can't wait to hear what you have to say right here, Sal, because I want to get your input on this whole scene or this whole relationship that's going on here between Moloch and Eddie Blake.
Well, I mean, you know, at first he busts in and you know, Moloch's basically sitting there crying in his office, and Eddie is almost, is imploring him to just, like, you know, kind of be a man, cowboy up, at least put up a fight. How, you know, it's like, why do you always do this? You don't even pull a gun on me, anything. And then we see that he's crying because he's watching the television, and we realize that it's the broadcast, the very famous broadcast of Cronkite cutting in nationally to announce that President Kennedy had been shot.
This is Walter Cronkite in our newsroom, and there has been an attempt, as perhaps you know now, on the life of President Kennedy. He was wounded in an automobile driving from Dallas Airport into downtown Dallas, along with Governor Connally of Texas. They've been taken to Parkland Hospital there, where their condition is as yet unknown. We have not been told their condition. At Dallas, in the downtown hotel room, a group had been gathered to hear President Kennedy when he was waiting his arrival. Let's switch down there now, where Eddie Barker of KRLD is on the air.
And that's when it hits us that this was all a setup, that Eddie was – they didn't want Eddie there because they were taking Kennedy out. And they knew that if he was there, it would be that much more difficult to do, if not impossible, to assassinate President Kennedy.
Okay. Now, see, I didn't read into it like that. So you're saying that the FBI.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's how I read it, is that this whole, because as this goes on, and it's really sort of interesting, at first, Eddie bursts in, and he's like, what the hell's going on? And then he realizes that Kennedy's been shot. And then it's this sort of scene of them both watching the television and reacting to it, as the whole nation did at that time. And you see Eddie, I think you see Eddie sort of realizing, oh, what the hell did I do? I should have been there. And then he asks Moloch if he's got any booze in the place. He starts drinking. And then, near sort of the end, he says, there ain't any drugs here, are there? And that was sort of, that was whole, the whole setup here, was that the FBI guys had told Eddie that Moloch had been moving from prostitution into narcotics, and that's why
he's making the realization that
they set him up. That they set him up because if he was in Dallas, he probably would have been able to done something. You know, like, it wouldn't. If he's there, it's that much harder to assassinate the president because, you know, he's a freaking superhero. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
So they had to get him out of the way in order to pull this off. As the scene goes on, and as we see him, react to it, and then him sort of sharing the moment with Moloch, as the announcement comes out, and in real time, it was like about 5 minutes from the point where Cronkite comes on the air to where they got the news that he was dead. It was about 5 minutes, I believe, if I remember correctly. So this is very much real time here, where they're sitting here watching it as the nation did. And then, Cronkite announces that Kennedy had died.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago. Vice President Lyndon Johnson has left the hospital in Dallas, but we do not know to where he has proceeded. Presumably, he will be taking the oath of office shortly and become the 36th President of the United States.
I thought, the very end scene of them just both staring at the television, Eddie's hand on his shoulder, Moloch with the bottle, the little pint in his hand, and him saying, "What are we going to do now?" I don't know.
What'd you think?
Well, I thought it was it's interesting because this now, once again, we see later on in the future where.
There is a rapport between these
two. There's a rapport between these two. They experience this moment, and then we see now, years and years later, when once again, there is this sort of world-shattering event in Eddie's life. He goes back to the guy that he shared that moment with. You know, it's sort of interesting to sit there and go, why? Because that was sort of always the weird thing. Like, why? I always wondered, like, why did Eddie go to Moloch? Why did he feel like that was the guy to go to when he, you know, when he found out about Ozymandias and the island and everything?
Yeah.
Why Moloch? You know, and I assume maybe it was just like, because Moloch wouldn't say anything to anyone who's going to, you know what I mean? Like,
no, it's because they shared a similar.
And now we see they shared this, life-changing, earth-shattering moment in history that changed, you know, everything. And now, once again, he has this, you know, moment that he doesn't know how to deal with, and he goes back to almost, you know, to his friend, I guess. I mean, in a weird way.
Yeah, that this is a whole very difficult notion. I think Azzarello had to pull off was that, you know, Eddie Blake is going and shooting at all of Moloch's minions and his guys just to get up there to slow down long enough to see. And, you know, we don't know a whole lot about Moloch other than the fact that he had the big casino in The Watchmen and he was dying. But, you know, he was emotional then, you know, and it right. Kind of figured because he had cancer, but he seems to be kind of a very in touch with his emotions criminal. You know, I don't know. I guess even the criminals back then had the respect for the highest office in the land.
Well, and I think what with to me one of the interesting things about Moloch and Eddie's relationship is that when it's in the moment. And they're doing this stuff where Eddie's bursting into his warehouse and shooting his henchmen and busting down the door to his office. It's a game.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's all part of the game. And Eddie likes playing it. And he likes the fact that Moloch is the guy that he's always going to beat. You know what I mean? Like, he's going to bully him. And Moloch is that guy that he can push around. But then all of a sudden, when shit gets real – and the game is interrupted by this or by, you know, later on in Watchmen by the events that happen there, that's when he can't deal with it. You know what I mean? Like, he can deal with all the craziness and he thrives in that and in the game of them two going back and forth. But, you know, I think Moloch is an interesting character in the sense of, you know, he was a magician and, you know, we don't know why he's doing any of this stuff. Like, why is Moloch a bad guy? We don't.
But
really
we can
ever
assume that he is taking part in the game, and he is seeing it as a game.
Right, in his own way, yeah. That, and maybe that's part of it too. Is that Moloch likes the game, but then, you know, when it gets a little too serious, he crumbles. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
he doesn't.
And maybe, you know, Eddie Blake knows that about him. And when Eddie crumbles, maybe it's easy for him to take it to another man who crumbles, and they've had this moment. It really is a great accentuator to what happened in The Watchmen, and this is well written. I mean, this is a well written character piece between these two. And it really, of all of the books that we've read so far, this really accentuates what the Watchmen are, you know, the things that happen in the Watchmen.
I agree. Yeah, absolutely. I feel like that Azzarello was able to really.
I feel like DC is doing what it is that they wanted to do, which was further the Watchmen, further, you know, let's keep digging around in the universe, and this is making sense. I mean, this is not a departure. I mean, sure, the storytelling is different, but you know, the characters are the same. So,
yeah, or at least they're they're consistent. They're at least, you know, you can see the extrapolation. You can see the logical idea behind. Okay,
yeah,
what
as far as the movie goes, we just took a shit all over the movie because I'm pretty sure that Eddie Blake shoots Kennedy at the beginning of that movie.
Well, yeah, they in the film, in the very, very beginning, in the slow motion kind of opening, they suggest that he was the assassin. And I think, if I remember correctly, even in, I think Hollis actually insinuates that to some degree in Under the Hood, that either Eddie knew about it or was part of it or something, but I don't know that it was ever, you know, once again, that's Hollis's perception, not necessarily truth.
I think that these writers, as each writer tells their own story of in the Watchmen universe, it's a good idea that they stick with whatever character's viewpoint of other people. That way, you know, maybe Hollis Mason got it wrong about the comedian. And that way, if things don't quite gel between Darwin Cook and Azzarello's take, maybe you can blame it on, you know. Well that's just Hollis Mason's viewpoint of it.
I hope that, you know.
I don't think that it'll be that loose, but I'm just saying.
I'm hoping that they're communicating
on
this
stuff. I'm sure they are.
You know, I'm sure that Brian and Darwin and all those, I mean, you know, are talking at least to some degree so that there's not some big, you know.
They're probably talking about you and this podcast.
I doubt that. I doubt that.
I don't know. It's out there.
The one thing I was going to bring up is that another, you know, if you look at Moloch, you know, it's not really strange for him to be respectful of, say, John F. Kennedy. If you look at, like, you know, him attending Eddie's funeral. You know what I mean? He went there out of respect of Eddie.
I think Moloch is not – he's certainly not the big bad. I think he's a big kid playing a game.
Yeah. And he just
– I still – I hope that no one ever explains his ears. I want them to be a mystery, you know.
I don't know if there was ever any mention of that whatsoever. I think while this issue is visually the least Watchmen-like, I think that, like you said, it really draws from the original 12 issues as well as anything. You know, and I don't care what I mean. This is a good comic. This is, you know, even if we didn't have the comedian originally from Moore and Gibbons, you know what I mean? Like, this is a well-written comic just on a guy getting caught in a situation, you know, just the concept, but the fact that it's the comedian and we know so much more about his character and how this is sort of deviating from that perception a little bit, it makes it that much more interesting.
Yeah, but you know, I still think that it does take us further down the Watchmen road, and I love it. I didn't get a chance to look at any of the other covers. Have you?
I did online. I looked at Rizzo had a cover that was pretty cool. It was sort of reminiscent of the scene with Night Owl and Eddie.
Oh yeah, I'm
busting
looking at
up the.
Oh yeah, that is cool.
Yeah, and then I think I saw the Jim Lee one too, but for some reason, like, as good as Jim Lee is, I don't think he fits.
Different, yeah. He doesn't fit here.
Yeah, it just doesn't fit these characters very well. I don't think it's too modern. It's too.
Well, he owns his own little place in comics, and you know this. But you know we're seeing a lot of different takes on and you know if he were to be the main artist on a Knock 'Em Dead story with Rorschach or somebody, you know, maybe he could sell it too. I would have never thought J.G. Jones and this panel layout would belong in a Watchmen narrative, but it works. I'll tell you now that I'm not a huge fan of this panel. To me, this is basic.
Which panel? Or you mean the panel layout?
The whole panel, the whole book, the whole panel layout. It's your average, you know, DC Comics fare. I don't know. There's something I like for my panels to not fit over each other. And this is all opinion and just one man's. I could be completely wrong in my opinion, actually.
Well, I think it
looks thin. It just looks like the panels are like little bitty pieces of paper that fit on top of each other. And that's not my least. That's my least favorite. Right. Of all layouts, but
to me, it's a little overly like it didn't need to be as complicated as he made it in some ways. Like it seems like on some of the pages, he's trying to make it more dynamic, and that may be due to the fact that a lot of this book is not action. It's people sitting around talking, and there's not a whole lot of action going on. So maybe it was his attempt to give it a little more life by, you know, sort of. A bit more of a chaotic panel layout.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if you look at Watchmen and Nine Panel Grid, a lot of that is just people standing around talking about stuff and not necessarily action, and it seemed to work okay then. But I don't know. I mean, you know, only J.G. Jones knows. Obviously, he didn't want to go with a Nine Panel Grid. Why? Maybe he's just not comfortable doing that. Maybe he wanted more of a cinematic... You know, a lot of this is sort of the widescreen, you know, four or five panels,
yep.
Full horizontal panels on a page. And you know.
Well, there's no problem following the story. And the colors served the story very, very good, too. Each scene has its own color palette that's present from panel to panel in the scene. I love that when artists are mindful of that. You know, it helps keep you here, and when you go from there to someplace else, the colors take you to another place else.
Yeah, I thought the colors were very good, and they certainly worked. You know, like you said, making those transitions. The other thing, I'm such a big fan of Eduardo Risso and Brian Azzarello on stuff like 100 Bullets, and I do look at this though and go, man, I kind of wonder what Rizzo would have done with this, if it would have worked as well or better. Cause I'm such a fan of his work, and especially I think he works so well with Brian's scripts. You know, they just work so well together, but I don't know, maybe it would have not worked as well because, Rizzo has such a distinct look to his stuff. It might have been hard to kind of see Jack and Bobby and Jacqueline, you know, in that Rizzo style. I don't know, or Marilyn, you know.
You want to take us into the two-page pirate Sailor Town?
Sure. We have the backup, the pirate story backup, the Crimson Corsair, Curse of the Crimson Corsair, and we see now that our hero of the story is in trouble. His mutiny failed, and now he's
damn it.
He's going to be because he has an aversion to keel hauling, we're not going to get to see the double keel hauling that we hoped for, but they're going to give him 50
crew keel hauling.
Crew, yeah, right. They're going to give him some lashes and then a court martial when they get back to land. So they break out the whip and they start lashing on him, and then just as he is about to, you know, pass out from the pain and of the lash, a Spanish frigate shows up and starts firing on the ship, and the captain's blown to pieces. The ship's on fire, and Mr. Well, I can't think of his name now. Do you remember his name? McLaughlin or something like that.
McLaughlin.
They had tied him to a cannon to lash him.
That's where they lash you at on the cannon.
And it gets blown off the boat and drags him into.
That's a bad scenario, right?
So he's kind of getting keel hauled anyway after getting lashed.
I would have rather went with the keel hauling. I mean, you know, at least you're not going to the bottom of the drink, you know.
I don't know. I think any of it would be pretty bad, but yeah. So that's two pages, and I don't know. You know, I'm not really digging the whole pirate thing. Like in Watchmen, the pirate story is, you know, it
takes you further along in each.
Well, it relates to the story overall. I don't see this one.
Well,
really.
Not only that, but there's something. I think there's something more picturesque in Moore's writing, maybe that just the little nuggets of what he says will really, you know, entice you to go further with it.
Well, yeah, it's done in the same way where we're hearing almost, you know, from the journal of the main protagonist of the story, but yeah, it's done in a different way. It's not as flowery here. It's not quite as
And you know that in and of itself is interesting to I don't know, but this is just as ghastly and, you know, morbid. Curiosity was probably what kept me going back to the pirate yarn in Moore's book. So,
yeah, Tales of the
adequately ghastly.
Tales of the Black Freighter, I think, though. I mean, and maybe you don't see it until the end, but it, you know, it relates to the main story, at least in some ways, of the fear of nuclear war and how that is affecting everyone, how fear affects everyone. And that's sort of what the point of it was to some degree, where this so far, because it's over all the issues, I don't know that, like, what, you know, what are they trying to tell me with this story so far? It's about a guy who's trying to save someone else and, you know, gets drugged down to the bottom of the ocean on a
It's way too early.
It's too early. Yeah. Too. I mean, you know, I don't know. We'll see. But it'll be interesting to see where it goes, and next week will be Night Owl number one.
Yeah, so. I'm looking forward to that one. Who's doing the art chores and the writing on Night Owl?
Oh gosh, why do you keep asking me these questions?
I'm trying to serve.
You
this
have,
is like a service podcast,
you
right?
You have the internet as much as I do, don't you?
Yeah, but I'm scared I'm going to jack you up if I start tinkering around on the
start typing.
Yeah, it's gonna, you're gonna get all crazy. Let's see.
Let me take a look before Watchmen. Night Owl. It doesn't say. This doesn't say who's doing it. I have no idea.
Well, is it Jim Lee that he's doing the cover next? Right? Is that's the one that we've seen?
Is he?
I think so.
Really?
I don't know.
I don't either. We don't know anything. We have no idea what anyone is doing. Okay.
Some service.
Night Owl is written by J. Michael Straczynski, with art by Andy Kubert and Joe Kubert. So we have the Kuberts and Straczynski.
Cool.
Yeah. I know there are a lot of people out there that are not big fans of really all three of those guys have their critics. So it'll be interesting to see, what we get from Night Owl. But, you know, I gotta say, you know, we're three issues in, and so far I've been pretty pleased with, overall the whole Before Watchmen thing. And, you know, just as far as, you know, how good is each individual issue? And so far, I think they've gotten better. Each one has gotten a little bit better, with this one so far being my favorite.
Yeah.
Easily. But, yeah, I don't know. I'm liking this whole Before Wild.
Yeah, I want to see where this one goes more than the. I want to see where all of them go, of course, but this one I'm really.
Well, this one I think so far has got the best story. You know, the Minutemen one was interesting, but it was kind of a setup issue.
Yep.
The Silk Spectre one was fun and cute, but you know. Kind of a romance-y teenage drama that doesn't necessarily, you know.
But you still want to know where, you know, what's going to happen on the horizon. And with this one, I want to know simply because I want to know more about what makes Eddie Blake tick. You know, I'm really intrigued by him. I want to know why is he a broken man that, or is he a haunted man that has these demons?
Well, you know, Eddie is a very complex character, I think. I mean, you know, he's a guy that, he fights crime, but is as much of a bad guy or as deplorable as or more so than a lot of the guys that he fights in a lot of ways, you know. So it's like, he's definitely an interesting character and... You know, probably in some ways the most human of any of them, in the sense of, you know, he's so flawed. And I think the frustrating thing about Eddie is that he's so convicted. You know, like he acts as if he has it all figured out, and yet he's like a psychopath and a, you know, sometimes looks like a raving lunatic.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely interesting. And Azzarello I think is just such a good writer. So I'm in on this one. No question.
Well, there we are.
That's it. I guess, that's the comedian number one. Nice job. Brax taking the reins and making sure I don't talk too much.
Well, I kind of defer to you. I read this twice. Like you did. And like you do when you kind of take the reins. But you see, when I read my comics, I'm usually on the throne. And, well, you know, you're always thinking about having to get off the throne when you're on the throne because you don't want to get, you know, you don't want to get roid rage or anything.
You don't want your legs to fall asleep.
Yeah, you don't want your legs to fall asleep. So you got that in your back of your mind and you're trying to digest the book. But anyway...
I do want to tell people, if you do listen to this and have any thoughts on what we've said about the issues, or you have things that we haven't talked about, or you have things we missed or whatever, please come to the website aroundcomics.com. There's a comments on every episode. You can add your comments. There's also, a newly, open forum that you can go to and post stuff about, each individual, episode that I put up. So yeah, feel free to come on by aroundcomics.com and it's there for you to tell us, what you guys think about it. So feel free, or, you can always get us on Twitter, at aroundcomics. You can always email us info@aroundcomics.com. We have a Facebook page, all the social networking stuff is out there. So feel free to contact us and tell us what you think about the episodes. Cause we'd love to hear feedback, on the stuff that we're putting out there.
We love to know where we were wrong.
We love to know where we were wrong.
And I want to go ahead and make the apology. You know, in the first episode, I said I wasn't a huge fan of Darwin Cook and I don't know how many people listen to Around Comics, but I'm getting some cars driving by the house, like really slow. I think it might be Darwin Cook.
Might be Darwin. He might listen, and he could.
Yeah, so I want to, you know, completely – just want to backpedal.
Did you really say – I didn't see it. I didn't even hear you say that.
I said that it's not my cup of tea. I mean, I can – take all of the story he's delivering with his art. I can follow it now, and, you know, and I'll wind up liking it at the end for that story. But, you know, it's – see, we're talking about how I don't like his art again. And
well, I don't know why you wouldn't like his art. He's awesome. I mean
– Molotov cocktails are going to be next, you know?
You're going to end up – you're going to have a horse head in your bed soon.
Oh, my God.
Darwin's old school, man. Darwin, you don't play. All right. Well, that's it. That's another episode that is Watching Before Watchmen, comedian number one. Next week will be Night Owl. And as always, thanks for listening. This is Sal. And
this is Braxton.
And that's it. Good night.
Good night.
He was a friend of mine. Was a friend of mine. His killing had no purpose, no reason or rhyme. He was a friend of mine. He was in Dallas town. Sixth floor window, a gunner shot him down.